Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast Extras. In this episode, we're doing a live recording at Hackfort, Treefort 10, Hackfort 2020, I believe. We have an audience of two. Say hi. Hello. Yay. All right. And with me, I have a special guest, Mr. Rob Wakely. Rob, welcome to the podcast. Please, if you could, introduce yourself quickly.
Yeah, I'm Rob Wakely, and I'm one of the presenters here at Hackfort. It's the first time I've ever done anything like that. I guess you could call me a digital nomad since I retired. Oh. And I've always had an interest in PCs and hardware.
Oh, cool, that's awesome. Well, as you may or may not know, the Hardware Asylum podcast is about computers, hardware, building, PCs, gaming, you know, anything technology related, kind of with putting computers together. So tell us about your first computer or your current computer. Let's start with that one.
Okay, my current computer isn't exciting at all. It's very utilitarian. Mm-hmm. It's a recent purchase of a Dell laptop that I use for work. And I'm embarrassed to say I don't even remember what the model number was, but it's a Dell laptop. It works.
You know, if you just say it's a Dell, I have an HP, so yeah, I don't know what the model number is, and I have it right in front of me. So if we go back in history, what was your first computer?
That would be, now you can get me excited.
Okay.
Apple II.
Apple II.
And Apple II, it wasn't mine. It was, I'm 62 years old, so back in the early 80s when this stuff was brand new, I was just entering the workforce.
Yep.
And I was I had a job, a work-study job in college, where my job is doing calculations on green spreadsheets and very tedious stuff, and there was a guy in the office that everyone made fun of that had an Apple computer.
Whoa.
And he was doing the spreadsheets on the computer, and no one took him seriously. But I did. I took them damn seriously.
So your Apple II, did you ever build a computer?
Later, I did build a computer. Later in the 90s, I don't remember the year, but I remember the go-to CPU was a 486.
Yeah.
And so I decided I was going to try my hand at building my own, like, IBM clone, mm-hmm. we referred to them back then. So I did build a PC with a few hiccups along the way.
Hiccups, do tell.
Well, to be completely honest, I didn't put two and two together and figure out what happened until I told you the story this afternoon.
Nice.
So one of the exciting things about building my own computer was I found out that I could get more advanced individual components that were available for retail sale.
Yeah.
Like, I can buy the faster chip, I was really excited about a brand new IBM hard drive that had come out that was super faster than anything, but it was so new it had not been incorporated in any of the major manufacturers, mm-hmm. but I could get my hands on one, and I could get my hands on a motherboard and a 486 chip, and how hard could it be? You just put the stuff together, right?
Yeah, it's like Lego, as they say these days, right?
So the first thing I found out about is you need to do this thing when you put in your motherboard called grounding. I didn't know what that was, and I found out the hard way that if it's not grounded, it ain't going to work.
Yep.
But I worked through that, and I put everything together, and everything was perfect except it wouldn't boot up, no matter what I tried.
That happens a lot. Similar story for me, putting computers together. I had a Tandy 1000 as a kid, and let's see, what was it? I learned programming on that computer, programming in BASIC. And then started high school, discovered girls, didn't care about computers so much. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, 4 years later, I get out, I start college, I get kicked out of the house. And at that point, I'm like, I'm kind of bored. So my good friend was starting to put computers together himself. And he said, hey, it's pretty easy. Just get this, put this together. And both of us are very mechanically minded. We're building engines and cars at the time. So I say, all right, that seems easy. So I went to a local computer repair shop and bought some used computer equipment because, you know, I'm in college. I didn't have a lot of money. I pick up this board and I say, well, I need a case. And he sold me a case and said, all right, I need, what else do I need? So he sold me a hard drive and a controller card and a video card. I get home, start putting all that stuff together. And lo and behold, first boot, awesome. It was great. Install Windows and DOS 6.22 on there. And I'm using this, and it's like, at this point, I'm like, well, I'm playing some of the old Tandy games on this computer. having a great, grand old time, but there was absolutely no sound. So at that point, I take my paycheck, go to CompUSA. You remember that store?
Oh, I remember CompUSA. You bet I do.
CompUSA was awesome. So I buy a sound card, and I come home, and I go and install the sound card, and as I'm pushing it in, I hear this crack. And nothing worked after that.
Crack as in motherboard.
Motherboard cracking. Ooh. And, of course, the PCBs back in this era were, I would say, cheaply made. I mean, they did what they were supposed to do, but they weren't really designed to be flexed. And it turns out I didn't install the motherboard correctly because there wasn't really any instructions. I had never done it before. And there was a couple of standoffs that needed to be put in, some little plastic tabs needed to be put in, and I didn't have those. So back to the repair shop I go and say, hey, my motherboard broke. And so he sold me a new one. I go and put that back in there, and similar to you, I put it in, I start it up, and it wouldn't boot. I'm like, what the heck? Turns out if I jostle the motherboard, all of a sudden it starts booting again. And I'm like, okay, so I did something wrong again. Mm-hmm. And this is where the two stories kind of converge, because I determined that there was a post that I needed to move because it was making contact with the ISA slot and grounding the entire motherboard. And that's likely what happened to you, because that ground will actually fry the chips and fry the processors and make it not work. And that was the danger of these old computers, because there was actually 120 volt power going to the main power switch. You know, nowadays it's a low voltage thing. You just, you know, jumper across two pins on the power supply and it fires up. Well, back in this era, there was 110 volts coming through, and there was a rocker switch. You thunk, and then you would turn on the computer. Sometimes those switches would break and people would get electrocuted.
Yeah, that my epiphany based on what you just said was, you know, I had left off and saying it wouldn't boot up, and I gave up and I brought it to a computer shop, and they called me and said, the 486 chip you have is bad, so we're just going to swap that out. And then you said, you know, you probably fried that when you grounded your, I'm like, oh crap, you're right. Now it only took me 40 years to figure that little tidbit out. But, you know, one of the things that I realized that when you're a single person building a computer, you don't have a lot of spare parts. Like if you're a company, you have spare parts, you can swap stuff out to figure out what the fail point was. But if you don't have spare parts, you can't figure out the fail point often.
It makes it tough. And that's something that I do at Hardware Asylum, is I write articles about computer hardware. And to be able to write articles about them, I need to have multiple versions of stuff. And I tend to hold on to some of that hardware. So I'll have a motherboard review, and then another manufacturer will send me a motherboard, and I compare the two back and back. And if I have problems, then I know I can switch stuff around. But these days, I'm a little more knowledgeable in putting stuff together, so it doesn't really break no more.
The big memory that I have from it is it felt so cool that I had built my own computer.
Yeah.
It was a source of pride every time I powered that baby on for a couple of years.
Yeah, it was an aha moment for a lot of stuff. So your presentation at Hackfort is about the technology between the 1980s and 1995-ish
era? Yeah, absolutely.
And as we both know, this is a very different time in computers. They're still relatively new. It's kind of, if you compare it with cars, it's the Model A era, where you needed to have a certain knowledge set to be able to use them, because there wasn't a lot out there. What got you interested in computers in this generation?
Well, it's back to that guy that was sitting with that Apple II, and he was doing spreadsheets electronically that everyone else had been doing by hand. And, you know, they were doing projections for new businesses, like full financial statements, projections over 12 months. And to do that by hand and have them typed up, it would, like, take a team of people a couple of weeks to do, when he could do it in minutes on the computer.
Yeah.
But he wasn't taken seriously because the machine he was using wasn't something that people trusted.
That kind of makes sense, because Apple II was, well, what was it? Steve Jobs always said they created the Apple II and the Macintosh to, you know, go to odds with IBM. IBM Big Iron, you know, that was the de facto office computer.
Well, in the operation I was in, there was an IBM mini computer in the basement in the accounting department.
Right.
And that was the only, that was like, it was like bowing to a god. IBM meant business. IBM was serious business. anything other than IBM was considered not serious business.
Yeah.
But I knew it was foolish. You know, I was 21 years old. I got it that I was looking at something huge, but the older people in the company just, they were very resistant to seeing it.
Well, they were accustomed to doing things the old way. They could actually trust that they wrote down the numbers correctly and add them up. They could look back on that. When you get a spreadsheet on an old Apple, very small screen.
Very small screen.
So it's really hard to see what's going on 10 columns over.
Right. If you had enough memory to do 10 columns, that was another thing.
Oh, that's true.
The memory was so limited that these big spreadsheets that I was talking about, we did manually, you could never do the whole thing on one file because there wasn't enough RAM. Mm-hmm. There was not enough RAM to fill more than if you had like 13 columns, one for each month in a total, and then rows for income and expenses, you could probably get down maybe 25 lines and you'd run out of memory. So you'd have to play the game of, I'm going to do this first file, I'm going to do calculations, and I'm going to capture the calculation results and combine that one row onto a new file.
Oh, right.
And so a whole series of projections would be maybe 6 or 7 different files you had to combine together, which would take a really long time to do to save and combine all the files. It would take an hour. Mm-hmm. But it was an hour of work versus a team working for 2 weeks. There's no comparison.
Yeah, not at all. So I noticed you focused a lot on the Apple II in your presentation, and obviously it was a very popular computer platform at the time. I'm a PC user, so I've never actually used an Apple II, at least that I remember. I do have a memory of going to grade school. My mom was volunteering, and they put me in front of a computer, and I got to play this game called Lemonade Stand, where you're running a lemonade stand and you have weather reports and the price of lemons and the how much you're going to charge for a lemonade. And the idea is that you make money. I looked that up because I had that crazy memory, mostly for this podcast. And I was like, what platform was that on? Turns out it was on the Apple II. But I have no idea what computer it was I was interacting with. I just remember that game. So any event, what was it about the Apple II that you enjoyed so much? What did you use it mostly for?
All right. So I only used it for creating those spreadsheets in the office.
Right.
The computer didn't belong to the company. It actually belonged to that guy they were making fun of. Mm-hmm. But everything changed on one particular day. That is the day they delivered the IBM PC to the office.
Right.
And this is a very vivid memory. I told you the accounting department was in the basement, and the way into the basement was a circular stair.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing the guy come down the stair with the box that said IBM on the side. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, it wasn't a joke anymore.
Right.
Because those three letters were enough for the doubters to go, okay, this is serious business. Mm-hmm. This is going to work. We're going to change over now.
Right.
Even though it was an inferior product to Apple, in my opinion.
Some people feel that way. All right, so this next question is a bit open-ended. And it's like, what do you feel the defining moment was in computers that gave them the edge when it came to business?
And that was it. It was you had to convince the old school that this was the new wave. And IBM knew that they had that power. Mm-hmm. And it was psychological power. It wasn't technology. It was psychological power. Right. It was three letters, IBM. and notice, when other companies jumped into it, what did they call the computers? They called them IBM clones.
That's true.
So you piggybacked on the credibility of IBM mm-hmm. by saying, I'm maybe not an IBM, but I'm an IBM clone. Mm-hmm. It's another way of saying not an Apple.
It's true. And then, of course, you make an Apple clone. There was a couple years where they were clones of Apples. And then Apple came in and said, no, you can't do that anymore. And ran them out of business, sued them and whatnot. But that was also when they were rolling into creating the Macintosh, which was this closed ecosystem of building a computer that was, in a sense, a toy. Mm-hmm. You could use it. And then when you were done, you would throw it away because you couldn't do anything else with it. Unless you took it to a technician and paid a lot of money to go and install what was like a hybrid card or whatever. Some of those upgrades that they added.
I started in Neiman Marcus Stores corporate in 1990, and my boss, the VP of credit, had a Mac in his office that he bought, not personally, but I remember in 1990, it was $6,000 for that Mac he had.
That was crazy.
And it was, everything else in the office was IBM, but he had his Mac that he loved.
And how do you suppose he was able to get that to talk to the IBMs at all?
No, not at all.
Yeah, so he just had it for
his own. It was for his stuff, you know. Yeah. And he couldn't share data.
Right. Well, one of the other aspects of your presentation was fraud control and checks, right? Being able to validate checks. And for some of the newer folks that are listening to this podcast, checks are a way that you can actually guarantee that money goes to somebody else.
The pieces of paper that the bank gives you that you sign and fill out.
And you fill out and say, I want to give $10 to this person. Here's my signature. I guarantee that money's there.
Yeah. I don't, and no one under 30 understands what that is.
Give them a card and swipe it and then we're done. Well, the card is basically a digital check.
Right.
And that with the way everybody is connected now, you can swipe your card. It goes directly to the bank. Debits your account immediately. Mm-hmm. But with checks, there was a defining time between when you could write a check, a definite time, I should say. You write the check, they guarantee you get to buy your stuff, you get to leave, and then they send the check to the bank, and the bank says, no, they don't have any money. You send it back, and now this company is out of cash. And out of the money that they were supposed to get. One aspect of your presentation was how you implemented a way to, shorten that process?
Well, shorten that process, and the fraud portion of it was, there's another instance where the check gets to the bank and the bank goes, that's not our check.
Oh, right.
That's not a real check, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that the banks used way back when, and they still use, is it's called a micro number, and people think it's saying micro numbers, not micro, it's micr, M-I-C-R. It's magnetic ink character recognition. Mm-hmm. Those numbers on the bottom of the check are encoded with a special magnetic ink that is very specific, and it's very difficult to emulate. Mm-hmm. You need special equipment, very specialized equipment to print those checks. And what I discovered was there's a reader that you can run that check through, and it'll say whether this micro line is genuine or not.
Oh, cool.
And so we found a way at Neiman Marcus, we replaced all the cash registers in 29 stores with IBM PCs. Mm-hmm. And we got those devices that could plug into the back of the through a serial cable, and we would run all the checks through there. So the fraudsters avoided us because they knew we had that check. So.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, that device was the one that had a little half circle, and you put the check in, and it
goes zoop,
spins it back around. Yeah. So at Neiman Markham, right?
They call it needless markup is what.
Needless markup.
It's Neiman Marcus. It's a very high-end luxury store.
Right. So when you implemented those IBM PCs, how did they synchronize to each other?
All the transactions went back to our IBM mainframe in headquarters in Dallas, Texas, and everything from check transactions to credit transactions. We also I was in charge of the proprietary credit card system too, all went back to a central database.
Right.
So that's how they essentially talk to each other. Your register was in a network on the store level, and that network communicated through interfaces with the mainframe real time.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, because some of those early systems like that, they had their local network, and then at night they would do a synchronization.
Right.
Then there was always a day lag or whatever.
Yeah, there wasn't a lag here, especially. You can't really, from a risk standpoint with checks and credit, you really can't deal with that lag. It's got to be real time, or the crooks will find out and they will steal you blind, taking advantage of that lag.
Yep. Yeah. And of course, the alternative during this time would be, and I remember going to stores and having this happen, write a check, and then they say, all right, hold on, pick up the phone and call a fraud protection agency to guarantee a certain amount of that check.
Yeah, that was a huge problem, especially for our high-end customers, where they've decided what they want to buy, they're giving you a check, and you're holding them up for another 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And saying no to to the wrong people often, because the check guarantee company doesn't care about your customer.
No.
They care about the risk. And if there's any risk, they're going to say no. They don't care if your customer never comes back. It's nothing to them. Mm-hmm. But it could be worth a fortune to Neiman Marcus for a high-end customer.
Yeah.
Something like 2% of the customers did over 90% of the sales in that organization.
Well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. You know, you go through any high-end mall and you see all of the high-end brands, Gucci or whatever, right? And there's really nobody ever in there. But when somebody does go in there, they're usually making a really big sale, and that's how they pay their rent that month.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so I had one last question here. Do you feel computers of the 80s and 90s are an important stepping stone to where we are today? Or do you think the fragmentation across the different platforms was more of a hindrance? And this is really more of the Apple Macintosh discussions and being able to talk to different computers.
You know, my experience in being in business in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, Apple really wasn't that much of a player in that space until much more recently.
Yeah.
And that's since I've gone on to other non-business ventures. But the way I remember it in those years is IBM, IBM clone, IBM, Dell, Hewlett Packard, that drove business much more than Apple ever did.
Yeah, well, and I guess that's where Apple kind of settled as being the home PC, the PC in every home sort of thing. It can be an Apple, even though in some cases it was more expensive than the Commodores and the other stuff you could buy during the time.
People used to say, hey, if you're an artist, you want to get a Macintosh.
Right.
Right. It's kind of the artsy option. If you want the workhorse, you get the IBM clone, you know.
Yeah, that's true. The last part of your presentation was more or less talking about how you use technology now and, you know, what is your current passion, which is, as I understand it, kind of roaming around and being the nomad.
But absolutely.
Not necessarily carrying a backpack and, you know, holding the beard and have your dog and a walking stick. You actually have technology with you. So I was wondering if you can kind of explain how that technology works with your current lifestyle.
Okay. There's a lot of technology in my lifestyle. I have a 2021 Winnebago Micro Mini trailer that I travel in. I've got a Ford F-150 that pulls it. I have my dog and my cat. I'm retired, but I still on a very part-time basis, I work, and that involves doing Zoom meetings, and it's got to be very highly reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So I need for my communication needs, I need power and redundancy, low ping times. I mean, right. I need to be able, no matter where I am, I need to be able to connect. Mm-hmm. So up until very recently, I was armed with cellular routers I've got a AT&T plan, I've got a T-Mobile plan, I've got a Verizon plan, and a Visible plan, which is part of Verizon. That's a whole nother story. But I've got a lot of technology, so no matter where I get, at least one or two of them will work. And a lot of times, the preference is for me to bind two connections together. Right. I use software called Speedify for that.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure I have a solid connection through Zoom. And then, you know, non-computer but still technology is I need electricity. And I'm out in I don't like going to RV parks. I just spent 2 months in the Arizona desert boondocking. So I have solar panels, I have lithium battery arrays,
mm-hmm.
and an inverter, converter I've got. So I'm very self-sufficient with technology. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to me. So my latest thing I got is Starlink. And Starlink is, they just went to offering that you could roam, so your address doesn't matter, so you can move just about anywhere and get this low orbiting satellite, low ping, low latency, high speed data for, well, it was $99 a month. They just raised the price $11, so it's $110 a month.
Well, it's because it's because they allow you to move around now. Because Starlink used to be, you had to have it tied to like a DSL line, which needed to have an address or something like that.
Well, it was, you needed a, when they first introduced Starlink, you needed a registered address. They have They have cells established throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And if you moved outside that cell, then you wouldn't be allowed to have access to satellites that serve outside that cell.
Right.
So what you'd have to do is you'd have to try to find an open cell and then change your address to that open cell. And towards the end, it was like impossible to find an open cell. Right. But now in the past 30, 45 days, they open it up, so that's no longer necessary.
Cool. So being off the grid, I mean, I'm familiar with solar, and really the proper way to implement solar is to have the inverters, and you have a battery bank, a way to store the power that you're collecting during the day. Of course, when you're living in the city, you usually have a high enough power consumption that you can't actually store that power, or you need a much, much larger array. Mm-hmm. But that really hasn't hindered you from using, you know, obviously Zoom, and I think you were saying you watch Netflix every night and binge when you can.
Yeah, yeah. I do everything that anybody else does at home. Mm-hmm. I have 300 amp hours of lithium battery storage.
Wow, that's huge.
You know, and for my purposes, that's more than enough. My theory is that you should have double what you normally think you need, so you have plenty of cushion. It teaches you to do things like be cognizant of the wattage that appliances you have used. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never used to do that living in an apartment or house. Who cares about wattage? Yeah. But now I can tell you what the wattage requirements of every appliance I have mm-hmm. is, and also water usage. You have to be very miserly with using water, because I've got a 32-gallon fresh water tank. Mm-hmm. That you could go through that in a day if you're sloppy.
That's true. Well, and I'm sure that some people may or may not know this, but your phone charger, if you leave that plugged into the wall, it's always consuming power. Mm-hmm. And you have to be cognizant of that if you're on a battery. It's like, well, I charge my phone, now you unplug it, because that will sever the connection.
There's a term for that we use. It's called phantom power usage.
Yep, phantom power.
Yeah. So, and I'm down to less than a single amp of phantom power usage in my rig.
That's awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, I wanted to thank you for being on the podcast and sharing your stories here at Hackport. Any questions for me before we conclude?
What was your favorite computer?
Oh, my favorite computer. That's a good question.
Because I didn't even answer that question. We can both answer that question.
Okay. My favorite computer was one that I built. No duh. And it was the second brand new motherboard I ever bought. It's a Pentium 2. Tyen brand. It was the Tyen Tiger, I think was the name. No, it wasn't Tiger. Any event, it doesn't matter. It's a Tyen brand. Pentium 2, 330 megahertz, and that got me through college, which is why I remember it, because that was also my golden age of when I was gaming a lot. So I had bought the Pentium 2, and then I put my Voodoo card in there so I could play a lot of first-person shooters. That's what I did.
Oh, Voodoo cards.
Yeah.
That's a memory.
And I also did 3D modeling. I did AutoCAD. You know, I have a degree in architecture, so this is what I did in college. It's like I needed a fast processing platform to do this architectural drawings and 3D modeling. And then, of course, game on the weekend. Well, strangely enough, I still have that motherboard. And I still pull it out to actually do some retro testing, because it still works and it's flawless. It's awesome. That's my favorite computer. And it's one that migrated to three different cases. You know, that motherboard had multiple hard drives. I changed the memory back and forth in there. So overall, it's kind of more so not necessarily a computer, but a platform for a computer.
So my answer to that same question, I looked it up because I didn't want to get any part of this wrong.
Okay.
You would think it would be the one I built. It isn't.
No.
It was my Dell. It was my Alienware. It wasn't Dell.
the
Alienware M14 XR2 laptop. And it was in 2014. And I think it was $3,000 back then, which in today's dollars would be, five or six.
Right.
But what a workhorse that thing was. It was beautiful. It was all these LED lights on it, and the Alienware thing, the eyes lit up. And that doesn't seem like a big deal today, but in 2014, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was envied when people saw it. It was a powerful laptop gaming PC. Mm-hmm. And guess what? I still have it, and it still works.
Awesome. That was where the what they called the desktop replacements, because they were big. You could carry them around, but they were not something you'd just sling over your shoulder and go to go to class and type up your notes.
Yeah, they home. Weren't. It was heavy, but it was a good feeling.
Yes, it was solid.
Yeah,
solid. All right. Well, hey, thanks again for being on the show, and have a great time in Boise.
All right. Thank you.